Welcome to part two of our interview with Bertie Green. Bertie, how are you? You're not sick of us yet?
No, I'm ready for round two. I like doubleheaders.
I like it.
Baseball terms.
Happy to continue the BBS story too, because that's a cliffhanger that I was excited for. I knew I got Eric's attention, so I know we'll get other people's attention too. For those that are uninitiated, bulletin board systems were kind of pre-internet, and then there was some overlap when internet came up. It was basically web hosting to create message forums for people to game together, file sharing, and a lot of these BBSs were encapsulated, and so there were cultures within there. So I got initiated because I had a neighbor that was much older than me, and he just started teaching me how to dial up on modems, how to play games, all that stuff. We got to the point where I wanted access to the Magic Castle and the Gate, which were the two BBSs that I was a part of, but I had used all my free credits. And so I asked my parents if I could dial the 1-900 number to get some credits. And my mom said, "What's a BBS? Bloody bull blank." And she's a funny lady. So I ended up finding out that the system operator or sysop of one of the BBSs that I liked, her son went to my school. Her name was Storm. I don't know what her real name is. She had big red hair. And she was easy to find. I found her at school and said, "Hey, I'm Bertie. You might know me by the screen name Dookie, Green Day Dookie." I didn't even know what it meant, by the way. It was just my first album. So I didn't know I had named myself shit. But anyway, I went and found Storm and said, "Hey, I would love to play games. Doom 2 had just come out and I really want to play. Parents won't let me. Here's what I can offer you." I don't know if y'all remember this. Eric, you might. But Doom 2 created the level creator. It was called a WAD creator. The files were .WADs.
Yep.
But they allowed players to create their own levels. And this is right at the point where big matches came into play. So 4v4 games and all that. So everyone was very excited to create their own levels and basically bring their friends on. Half of those files were corrupt and weren't playable. Mm-hmm. The other half were crap and were just sitting there on these servers. I figured, hey, my parents want me to learn how to use the Zip and Ditto drives from iOmega. I'm basically swimming in external storage right now. So let me offer basically archiving services. I'll make sure these levels run and I'll make sure people are playing them or I'll remove them from the system. And that got me some free credits to play. My parents at that point did start paying because they saw what it was that I was doing. They didn't know what I was really asking, but that was basically how I started getting into hacking. It wasn't termed hacking. It was just tech.
That's really cool. So, Bertie, you were a managed service provider, and you didn't even know it. You were an MSP way back in the day. Wow, yeah. providing services. That's pretty cool. So, BBS, I remember the first thing I think of is a super high phone bill as a surprise with BBS.
Yeah.
My mom, she let me. So, I had a Commodore 64, and the way I learned how computers worked was actually at the aisle in Kmart, because I saw a screen on a Commodore computer and it showed basic programming, and it showed like line number 10, clear the screen, line number 20, print something, line number 30, ask for input for something. And so I just started tinkering with it and I started adding to it. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. Back in the day when I was younger, I had a paper route. I mowed lawns for money, and that's what I did. I was like probably 10 or 11 or whatever. And then I saved up money and I bought my first Commodore 64. It was $188. I bought it on Montgomery Ward. And then I bought a tape backup so I could, once you shut off the computer, you could actually save your files. And then in there was magazines back then for Commodore. And in the back, there was programming so you could write your own programs. And so you would tediously type in all of these lines of code and hopefully you didn't get it wrong. You would save it to your files. And then I saved up and I bought a disk drive, a floppy disk drive, and it was like $300. So like the prices were insane for, you know, what you got, but you got to learn. That was the good part about it, is you, all that money went to learning. Then I got a modem. It was a 300 baud modem, which is incredibly slow, but back then was pretty good. I hooked up to CompuServe and then I thought, oh, this is pretty cool. I can do all this stuff. I can search for things. That's when you could search for keywords and you could do all these things. You could send messages, you could talk to people, whoever was online, not many people back then. But that was the good thing about learning. And then finding bulletin board systems, that was really cool. You could share files, you could chat with people. Then when the internet came about, when it was shared beyond universities and other institutions, you could actually link into the internet. All of that learning, that brings back memories. That is some really cool learning. I mean, in nowadays terms, it's very antiquated, but that was the basic blocks for learning. And that's what Bertie is going to tell us about. So we want to hear more about that.
It really community based, and that was the thing, Eric. I mean, I feel like I was 11. My screen name was Dookie. I didn't know what it meant. but everyone was so helpful. I remember that. Everyone made you feel welcome. Everyone helped. We had GTs, get-togethers in person, and we'd all meet up at Laser Quest. We'd bring our PCs, so we'd have all the PCs in the middle of Laser Quest, like the foyer area, and we'd switch between Doom matches, Laser Quest. Doom match, Laser Quest.
LAN parties. Remember that? Taking all your stuff, all your heavy giant monitors, all of that. That's really cool.
It is amazing how far it's come about. But what I love what you just said about there is the support in the communities. I found that there's that assumption that I don't know if I ought to go into this because I'm going to get slammed. And just to hear that, how much did that contribute not only to your learning, but also to your future knowledge base and the addendum to that knowledge base?
That encouragement, absolutely. I showed up to that first GT with my dad. No one knew I was a kid. So when I showed up, they were like, "Who is this?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm Dookie." And they were like, "What?" And so the sysop grabbed me and like danced around the room with me. And I was just like very accepted as a kid. And then I think of other people. Dr. Saltmarsh was my sixth grade science teacher, and he encouraged me to sign up for an Intel competition to create a web page in HTML. Absolutely, I did that. I did not win. But those kind of encouragements were really paramount to me. And that's what I try to bring to people I work with now, because I had a lot of people help me and go out of their way. Can I do the same for others?
That is really huge, especially at that age, because there, like you said, nobody knew who you were with your screen name. And they're like, whoa, okay, this is just a younger kid. But that's the good part about learning and learning over the internet and being able to self-learn, but then also have encouragement from others and have other people take the time to share their experience and maybe the right path to learn something that they want to accomplish later. So that's really cool. That's and everybody's accepted in that, which is even better.
I'm going to make a segue in another thing here because we talked about BBS, we talked about learning and such. And I'm sure that learning led into further coding. This is something that Eric talked about this morning that I thought was interesting too, because adults that aren't traditional coders, that may have done some tech years ago, but now, what are some of the things that you learned from your early days of coding?
I think that that's a good segue into the next part of this is adults who have progressed in their career. And so you start out, you're maybe an analyst and you do some coding, you do some development, and you're very technical and you learn different languages, programming languages. You learn some scripting, you learn how to compile code and then contribute. Once you progress in your career, you're more of a supervisory type of role where you have teams and you understand what they're doing and you understand what the business wants to do. And so you meet those objectives and you fine-tune it as you go and you make adjustments where you go as you go. Through that, a lot of the people who progress through their career as they get older, they lose a lot of those skills. And so staying current is super important. And so now we're seeing, especially within the last couple or few years, people are taking time out to go back to learn at least the basic level of coding, whether it's using Python scripting or whatever they want to do. And so they're making projects, they're building things, they're sharing things with others, they're sharing things within their own GitHub or GitLab repositories. They're working with other people, learning how things work, especially with AI and scripting and APIs and other things. That's pretty awesome. But the other thing it does is it bridges the gap between losing that technical ability and being astute with current technology. You're more on the same page with your technical teams that you're working with. And instead of putting up a wall and saying, well, I did technical things like 20 years ago, I don't need to learn this. Well, it's not being very good. It's really putting yourself at a more competitive edge when you're willing to learn the current technologies and take that time and sacrifice the time to learn it rather than just referencing back to things that were 20 years ago, which in internet time, that might as well be 100 years ago.
I think what you're referencing, Eric, is when people say, "Hi, yeah, I was a COBOL developer, so I get it." And it's like, "What? You get what? What do you? That was a long time ago. What are you saying you get?"
Yeah, things change super quickly. And so being able to be current is extremely important.
I like staying on top of current trends. I also recognize that the human mind is limited in capacity. It's kind of like never-ending story that every time you learn something new or make a wish, you lose something. In that exchange, if you're a proprietor of a business and you are serving your employees and your consultants, you might not need to know how to code because your job is really serving others. But let's say you're a chief technical or a technology officer and you can't code. Get solo learn. It's the same as Babbel for learning Spanish, and you can learn Python. There's no excuse. It's on your phone. So I do think it's important to understand the languages and more about the trends and comprehending what those coding languages enable for you and for others than becoming a master. You know, you don't have to create production applications, but understand how these tools work.
That's a great point, Bertie. I know that 10 years ago, I was working in the field of static application security testing. And so looking at code, and I wasn't a coder and I knew the basics of coding, but I couldn't code anything to really save myself. However, I did know when there were security problems. I could identify things. So I knew the code good enough for the things, the parts that would get people in trouble, and then also understand the recommendations. So when I was out in the field actually looking at people's desktops and analyzing things, I was able to do it that far, which was part of our business, which that made it very important to understand and know that. Now, so Bertie, you said there were some resources. I would like to know how to get better at coding myself. Like I said, I can do something very basic and that's about it. What are some good references for, say, people like me who know more of the business side and who have lost maybe quite a bit of technical learning, but really want to understand that more and immerse themselves into that?
Great question. And the usual IT answer of it depends, but I will share the array of options. I like Babbel for learning Spanish and other languages, for example, that basically introduces you to how the words, and I will go back to coding here, but how the words work, how verb conjugation works, and then fill in the blanks, put the word here, put the word there. And then eventually you're typing the word, you're not placing the word. So that's incremental learning versus just dropping you in the deep end. And applications like Solo Learn, which is a phone app that I used, uses the exact same methodology, but for Python, Golang, Java, all those. So that's a really fun way while you're sitting on the couch to knock out a few things and just do it every day kind of deal. To notch it up, there's things like Code Academy, which I think is really great, where they have consoles within their web browser if you want to, and you are building projects and you're going through learning in depth. I also love W3 Schools, which is .org, I think it is. And they have how to code, and it's just written instructions that you can do at your own pace. It's all really mix and match. I jump between them depending on where I'm having trouble.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I do a little bit of language learning as well at a small level. And so that does make sense because you do see different resources which can help you in certain ways. And then you kind of get stuck and then you look at a different way of learning it. And so it helps build your skills.
I have one more too. Those are great ways to learn, but that's learning the hypothetical. And hypothetical learning is a little more difficult for me because when do I apply this knowledge? And I just get wrapped around the axle. So at a certain point, create a project. Like you were asking about GitHub and GitLab, just what is it that you would like to do and code it, right? There are sales tools that I wish I had, so I just started building them. You know, in Google Sheets, I have all the different data that I would like from a sales tool populated instead of having 10 different tools. So just build something for yourself. And that feels more running towards an end zone versus just running around a racetrack. You know, I feel like I have an end goal and a purpose, and that drives me more.
So you're geeking me out here because now you're talking some of the language that I learned in my education, and that was it means nothing when I say andragogy and pedagogy, but it's just two different academic styles. Pedagogy is the stuff that you teach kids, and it's basically you do this. It's a very sequential type of thing. Think of all the math that I really couldn't stand. Right, an algorithm. Why would I ever need to learn an algorithm? That's the dumbest thing I ever heard. Now these kids are applying those in from an andragogical side or to your point, learning by doing and applying it to something that's relevant. So if you say, hey, man, we're going to use algorithms right now to go build a system or to help build this game. Hey, these kids are all in. And so it's that paradigm shift of education. And I'm interested in how do you get to that point? How do you get people to go from that pedagogical method of very much rote and such, then show them, hey, this is another way of learning. And not only that, this is much more personalized to you, because too many organizations are still stuck in that pedagogical sense versus the andragogical. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense. Just in my experience with the mentees I work with, you stay in the hypothetical for as long as you can. Mm-hmm. And then you wait patiently for your chance when they say, man, I wish. And it's like, oh, you can, you know, because that's kind of empowering at that point too. Instead of saying, hey, at some point, I'm going to challenge you to build something. At that point, people are on edge. So you really look for that, hey, you can do it. And you know what? Use ChatGPT, use these different tools, get it together. And it may look like crap, but it's your crap, you know, it's your craplication, my friend, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's where refinement comes in. So this is awesome. That's where you get the opportunity, and it's an opportunity then that you can execute on. So you make a decision, you say, wow, is this overwhelming? Is it super hard? Is it something I can start out in little chunks and then do a little bit? And you're right. At first, a lot of these projects, they look like total garbage at first, but then you start getting ideas and then you start asking AI questions.
Yeah.
And you get a little bit of help with that kind of assisted intelligence. And then you get ideas. And sometimes the return from AI is kind of garbage-ish, but you can get some ideas from that. You can say, oh, that's kind of cool. I got an idea. And so I'm going to take a little bit of that and put it back into here. So I think it's refinement. And then when you refine, like, I don't know, 10, 20 times, then you get a really nice product. Mm-hmm. That's how I've seen it. But it does take that initial step, that initial leap, because that's probably the hardest part, is to try to tackle something that looks pretty difficult, but you know that you can do it. It's just going to take you a journey to be able to figure it out.
The right project, and this is a nerdism, it's more fun than video games. Like, I can't, if I have a cool project that I'm coding, I can't play video games because I'm like, this is somebody else's thing. I want it. It's more like, this is something I can completely customize for me. And I'll go in little coding sprints for like a week. And you have this big monolithic app at first, which breaks really easy because everything happens in one file. And then you start breaking it up into microservices and you start having orchestrators. So to your point, you have a framework that you start with just to see it work. And then you iterate. That's what a lot of these things are, is iteration and diligence.
It's amazing how many people are afraid of that iteration. It's okay to fail. It's applied learning continuously. Eric, you had something else too that we were talking about. And what was that? Remind us.
So yeah, Bertie, I would like to hear more from you about your thoughts on continual learning and then also a parallel path with artificial general intelligence and how AI is really learning to do things like a human, not just single type of application, but really multi-application to think as a human and change direction at any time. What are your thoughts as artificial general intelligence improves? And then how do humans maybe accelerate their learning as they get older?
Artificial general intelligence seems to be increasing as the applications get more context. An example would be ChatGPT. I'll ask how to build one script, and it has no idea what that script is doing in engagement with other scripts or tools that I have. So it's just very siloed. Yeah, GitHub Copilot, for example, if I code with that, I'll add my whole repository there, and I'll say, hey, look at this script and how this script will engage with this database. And it looks at the entire application and it gives me recommendations. So the ability for AI to have more general intelligence is based on the context we provide it and how smart our prompting is. But I think a lot of it is how much we enable it to see. And I am not concerned, but I'm not worried about AI taking over in that fear sense, because there's so much data going in. It's based on all the things we think and do. So we're loading in a lot of good data, but mostly bad. And so those tools are going to be refined. It's basically just an example of humanity, I guess you could say, you know, because we're the ones feeding it the data. it doesn't have an opinion, right? It's based on our opinions and how we weight those things.
Yeah, garbage in, garbage out. So,
yes.
And it's interesting because AI, when I've used it to do whatever, find some text or be able to write something for me or refine something. I use it a lot for refinement on words or, you know, paragraphs or whatever that I send to it. It never says it's wrong, like that it has a wrong answer, which is kind of concerning, but it will give you an answer. I think the word is it's non-deterministic. And so you can have kind of it arrive to generally the same outcome, although it can take different paths when you do like a regenerate. So it's pretty interesting. But what I find is really interesting in the future is how humans will learn and interact with artificial general intelligence or just artificial intelligence and be able to kind of reconcile each other, understanding that we have humans and we have machines that are learning at a very fast pace, and how the two work with each other.
Finding that balance. I mean, it's. I heard another gentleman compare artificial intelligence to the printing press and said Gutenberg did not kill writing. So whatever people are worried about AI taking their jobs, I think it's more about how AI can impact your job and change what you're doing, but it doesn't replace. I'm sure there are places it will replace. That's too much of a catch-all. But finding the ways to augment yourself, like Sandy Dunn has been doing. We talk about Sandy Dunn, who spent the last year and a half deep diving into artificial intelligence, learning everything she can. She finds all the ways she can augment her capabilities. I couldn't code full applications before. I could only do that when I had AI assistants. And so these things are bridges for those folks who want to do something a little outside their capability. And I see particularly people who have imposter syndrome doing very well with ChatGPT because it's that little extra validation of, is this script correct? When what they often mean is this script perfect? And it doesn't need to necessarily be perfect. And so it's that little extra confidence people need.
Yeah, well, okay. So here's the path I was thinking about. It sounds like there's really going to be more of an opportunity. And like you said, there might be minimal job replacement where there's automation. However, if you do compare it to the printing press, look at all of the jobs that it created after that. There's all of these parts that things that people weren't doing before. And so take a step back to about 30 years ago, there were projections saying, here's all of these new jobs that are going to be out there that are created by the internet. And so it was a job creation type of implementation where now there's that same opportunity. And so understanding how to work with AI as humans, I think will be super important.
Yeah. I mean, prompt engineer is a great first example. Prompt engineer didn't exist until AI came around. So we're automatically seeing or already seeing new jobs that didn't exist. And so there are shifts. I feel for the people who are displaced directly by AI. I also recognize that if your job is completely automatable, then you should have a little more risk aversion. And that's a scary place to be if you can be fully automated.
Well, in that place, start learning. Like you said, I mean, this is an opportunity to be able to start learning new skills. If you think, okay, what I'm doing is replaceable with automation using AI, then you've got the opportunity to, in parallel, while you understand that that cycle is going to happen, to be able to learn new things, to work with AI, to then be part of that automation. And then you've created a new job in a new setting for yourself.
Yes, we are just scratching the surface of what it can do. And a lot of these folks in the workforce are waiting for those opportunities because not all of them can create something net new with AI. So the world has to shift a bit for people to be able to grab on and go with the momentum. But I think that is coming quickly. I think we will be better for it. There's obviously bad stuff that's done with it, but true of everything. Bad things can be done with anything.
Yeah, totally. Look at an automobile, right? When those were invented, you could take someone to the hospital or you could rob a bank with it. So you can do good and bad things with it. So now with security people with AI, that's also another huge part because think of all the data you're putting in it. There's different things like prompt injections where attackers can change the integrity of prompts. They can steal data back from the returns that it brings. So there's many different things that people that are involved with information security could do as a part of AI. And so I think that will increase the opportunities for security personnel to learn those things, along with doing things like working with AI for reading logs. I know there's a lot of applications that my teams have used in the past, more machine learning that learn normal security log behavior. And if there's a problem, they escalate alerts to people to say, hey, look at this, this is a problem. And so learning how to work with AI and using it as a proactive item with security is super important. So there's a lot of things that information security people can do using AI to increase their ability to further their careers.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, and like log analysis and all that stuff that's very heavy and looking for patterns. Absolutely, it's helpful there. I know SOC teams that provided level one analysts access to ChatGPT for them to create scripts and things like that and plans, and that completely accelerated their capability to deliver their job. So I do think there's a lot of areas you're talking about, both protecting from poisoning ChatGPT and LLMs in general, as well as how the hackers can leverage these tools. As of right now, I think a lot of people are either they're going one of two ways. I'm seeing hyperbolically. They're either saying no LLMs, don't use any LLMs or anything for work, or we're all in. And I feel like having a bit of a, like anything else in security, context to what your business does. I realize you have to slap AI powered onto it, like Oral-B did their toothbrush, just to stay relevant. But at a certain point, it's diluted. You know, what are we talking about anymore?
Yeah, AI is on everything. That's interesting. Yeah, so, and it's interesting because some people or some companies or branding or whatever it might be, it might not really be AI, it might be ML, you know, machine learning, it might be robotics process automation, RPA, it might be some variation of that. But I do agree with companies, they need to embrace AI. We talked about this before, because the engineers on their staff are going to use AI. You can't just completely ban it altogether. You can put some boundaries around it, saying, okay, here's things that we can use AI for. And here's looking at the data layer, our sensitive data that we do not want to put into anything else. And thinking about that in terms of who is controlling the data. If it's in our bounds, then if we're taking it out of our bounds and putting it in something else, we've lost control, essentially. There needs to be, I guess, policies, standards, and frameworks around that. And then a lot of education to the company of, hey, we're using AI to do things better, but here's things that we're putting also some restrictions on. Mm-hmm. And this is how we can also show our customers, maybe as a third party, that this is how we're protecting your data. But here's how we can provide accelerators into other parts that are not going to put your data at risk.
Policy, a great place to start. I totally agree. And it's kind of like when companies would try to block Spotify and Pandora, like, we're going to keep our employees on task. We're not going to pay for you to listen to that music. If you block it, they find another way.
They
you
will.
Know? And so
VPN
it
or something
seems very
else.
Similar. It's VPN or they got it on their phone and they got sure. a headset in, they will find right. a way. And so it's more about again, to the psychology of, if you know people are going to do something, you find that compromise instead of just saying no and then turning a blind eye, knowing the behavior is happening anyway. You know, yeah. That's shadow IT. That's
shadow IT. Absolutely. Yep. And that's part of IT security governance, is just understanding all the bits within your company of every way, everywhere people are using your systems. And again, with customer data, company data, employee data, and understanding, and even things like marketing events. So if you're hiring a third party to do a marketing event, your IT staff should know about that, because when you're done with it, they should remove those accounts that the people that went to that marketing event were part of. And so having the IT people, the security people, be your friends, saying, yeah, we're doing this thing, help us out with this, so that when we're done with it, we can clean it up. And I think it's just that communication and understanding as a part of that. Sorry, I'm preaching now.
No. The other part I want to add to that is, like, this is AI's marketing emergence. AI and ML have been around for a long time. Fred Brown, the cowboy CEO, if you look him up, he had AI patent like 21 years ago. Every time you text someone to duck off, that's autocorrect that didn't work. And that's AI.
I saw a shirt that said, that's autocorrect, dear autocorrect. It's never duck.
What I like about this is a continuation of what we were talking about with Joe Sullivan on that AI. It would have been interesting to have him on the program too, to geek out over all these things and everything.
We need a panel.
Yeah.
We need a panel, and we need to invite Sandy as well. She's very time limited though, so I don't know.
We'll figure it out. She's popular. This went just as I thought, because this is so much information. Again, this is something that if any of you in the audience would like to hear more about, let's continue on the conversation. This diverged into something that I didn't anticipate. It was a simple topic of self-learning, and it went into all other aspects of learning. So this has been an incredibly robust conversation. I can't thank you enough for sharing those nuggets of wisdom.
My pleasure. And I'll leave you with a final thought that when ChatGPT first came out, all of my friends who were studying for things, I create a little ChatGPT icon and I said, here's your study buddy for real estate. Here's your marketing buddy for blogs, right? Instead of saying, here's all of what AI does, it's like, here's what it does for you. And here's the icon, you know? So just enabling people to use it for that one thing.